Visiting today with Senator Matt Himsel. Senator Himsel served in both the State House of Representatives and the State Senate for a total, I believe, of 24 years. And prior to then, in the 1950s, served as a Republican County Chairman in Flathead County. And Senator Himsel, maybe I could just begin by asking you to kind of recap the early stages of your career, and we'll kind of take it from there.
Well, thank you, Bob, for asking me to share some experiences and observation on the 60 years of community service in Kalispell. When I came to Kalispell in 1945, Kalispell was a small town. The businesses were all privately owned, with the exception of the Missoula Merck, which was controlled from Missoula. There were just three banks in town, six doctors. Now there have about 173 and more coming. The six soda fountains in the drugstore. No big grocery stores. And there were about six lawyers and no CPAs, one radio station, and about seven car dealers. In the 15 years that the county went through 10 years of a depression and the 4 years of war, changed the structure somewhat. Speaking now of the political organization, those years produced Democrat representatives in the state and in the county offices. The old guard for the Republicans were quite active, all right, but they were in the minority. I recall in particular that the leadership at that time was in Gurney Mossam of the Whitefish, Ori Armstrong of Kalispell, and Pink Miller, Charlie Jellison, Al Johnson, and Cap Landstrom, along with Harry Keith, who was a representative, really, of the Missoula Mercantile.
And all these men were Kalispell men, is that right, Matt?
Yes, yes. These are Kalispell
people. Except for Gurney Moss, who was from Whitefish.
Now then, in 1945, after the war, there's an entirely different movement in the community. The younger people came back, and they were kind of the Young Turks in the political process. There were Jim Murphy, Bob Sykes, Merritt Worden, Fred Broder, Marshall Murray, Con Lundgren, Sterling Ring, Roger Baldwin, Clyde Smith, Tom Jones, and Vic Morgan were mostly of the new tribe that came in here. The county at that time had some Republican representation in Glenn Milhouse, Cliff Haynes, Don Buckingham, and later, of course, Guype and DuPont.
Now, Guype and DuPont, Howard Guype and Jim DuPont, and the other names you mentioned were all men who served in county public office in Flathead County.
Yes.
In the courthouse.
They represented the growth or switch from the Democrat control to the Republicans. And it was led largely by Vic Morgan, who was a young fellow that came to town and purchased the Interlake and was an aggressive Republican, and largely through the efforts of all these.
The Interlake is the Kalispell newspaper.
Yes. The tide kind of turned and started in so that the Republicans got representation. And among the, I'm sure I have forgotten some of them, but also the women played an important part in their effective organization. There were a club that not all of them were organized, but those that I recall particularly were Marion Abbott, Dorothy Stenson, Floss McClellan, Jane Lopp, Jane Nye, Joan Dellison, and Ramona Jellison, and Polly Nicolaisen, and Jean Amsbury. They've brought in a new force into the political picture. And then, of course, following there were some new kids came to town, including Bob Brown, and John Harp, Jerry O'Neill, Bill Boharski, Dick Nelson, Roger Somerville, Rod Bitney, and I'm sure there were others, but that gives you a change in the political complexion of the county and the support which changed from a Democrat to the Republican. And it began in about the 1964, about the, when this change really started to come about. And if you remember, there was a quite a bit of interest in the John Birch Society, and also it made quite a difference in the state's representation, which was divided for the Goldwater supporters and in the contest with Nelson Rockefeller and Miles Romney and Governor Scranton for the national presidency campaign. And from that time on, the tide seemed to develop in favor of the Republican philosophy. Part of it was brought about, I think, by several changes in the development in the community. The state had some extensive development in the watershed. Fort Peck came into being, which was largely credited to Senator Wheeler. Hungry Horse came was finished in 1953, to the credit primarily of Senator Murray. But also at the time, nationally, there had been this movement for the Tennessee Valley Authority. And there was some concern here with the development of the water resources. And the exciting thing at the time was that the power from the Hungry Horse development was moved from, well, they had a line through the valley, but then all of a sudden it developed that they put in a new line up on the high line from the mountain tops around here, with the fear at the same time that the lake was going to be raised, they're going to dam that up Flathead Lake so it would be 25 feet higher than the dam, I think, which would flood a part of the county. And so there's kind of a ghost floating around that it might be a plan for the Columbia Valley Authority. And that the people had had enough of that. They'd gone through the period of the Depression where we had all kinds of government activities, programs, WPA, PWA, and CCC, and the whole effort that was made. They didn't know where this might stop. And it seemed to be quite a possibility that we ought to take a different look at it. And that gave the Republicans a chance to get in back into control.
Matt, let me just kind of summarize that, see if I understand that clearly. The Democrats were the party then that developed the big project, the big public power and irrigation project, the Tennessee Valley Authority. And so they would be associated with that kind of a project. And there was some concern or suspicion that through a similar kind of a project involving the Flathead River drainage and Flathead Lake, they might dam up the Flathead River south of Flathead Lake so that Flathead Lake would expand north, clear up into the Flathead Valley, including the areas occupied by probably Kalispell and Columbia Falls and Big Fork. And part of the reason people believed that was because some power wires, which could easily have been strung down in the valley floor, were up on the hillsides. And it made people wonder, well, why would the government have gone to the extra trouble and expense to do that if they may not have had some idea in mind of flooding the valley floor? And since people kind of suspected that the Democrats might be interested in a big project like that because they'd already been involved with the Tennessee Valley Authority, it was fairly easy to spread that suspicion. And I think that was where Vic Morgan came in. Vic Morgan was instrumental in spreading the idea that that could be the case.
Yes, and that's right. And I should mention also that the whole Columbia River was being dammed. And this, we had the dam here in the South Fork, Middle Fork, and there was also a possibility of a dam in the North Fork. Okay. And so people were quite disturbed about that, and it was an element that wasn't very popular in there. They didn't want any more of those kind of developments for fear that it would just take over the whole valley.
And they associated that kind of development with the Democratic Party.
Yes, yeah. Sure. They were. That was the movement. All those dams were all sponsored by Democrats. And they did provide jobs, temporary jobs in the construction period, but they didn't know if that was just the end of it or if it was going to go into a government program from the dams as they served the valleys. I think that was a period in which the switch really took place.
And that was actually kind of developing in the 1950s, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and well before that, it started like Fort Peck earlier than that.
Okay, the 1950s.
Over in the east.
But Vic Morgan came to Kalispell, what, in the early 1950s?
Yes,
yeah.
In that time. The switch to in the state office, I think, came about, or in the governorship came about that time after, that was when Governor Aronson came in. And his.
Now, Aronson was the Republican who was elected governor in 1952.
Yes.
And he beat Bonner.
Yes.
Do you remember anything about that campaign? You were the Republican county chairman, I think, then.
Well, Bonner had some difficulty in his personal life, I think, made that big difference, but Aronson wouldn't talk about that. The Aronson's force was for oil and gas development. He was in favor of that. And there was the young Olson.
Arnold Olson.
Arnold Olson was a challenger in opposition to that idea. And that gave Aronson the force to campaign and be elected.
And Olson was the Democrat Attorney General at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he served in the National Congress
later on,
several
yeah.
times
yeah.
for a long time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Republicans had Nutter elected, but it didn't last. He died in that plane crash.
Yeah, Governor Nutter was elected in 1960 following Governor Aronson.
That put Babcock, who was the lieutenant governor, put him into a term in office. And
now, Matt, I want to ask you a couple questions about, we've talked about the big public projects, the hydro projects, and of course Hungry Horse Dam was one that was completed. And I think when Mike Mansfield was a U.S. representative, a congressman from Montana, he came here to the Flathead Valley for the dedication ceremony at the same time that you were the Republican county chairman in Flathead County. And you and he, I think, he called at your office and and you drove him up to the ceremony. And I've always found that a good story because, of course, you were the Republican county chairman and he was a Democrat congressman. What was your relationship with him? How did you meet Mansfield? How did you know him?
Well, Mansfield was a professor in the university.
In Missoula.
And I was in graduate school. I was never a pupil of his, but I was in graduate school when he started his campaign in the first place. As a matter of fact, I think I, as among the students, I contributed to that first campaign, which incidentally he lost the first time he tried. But
lost the Democratic primary for Congress, I think, in 1940 or something like that.
I knew him not so intimately. I didn't have him as an instructor, but I knew him as a person. And so when this damn ceremony came up, I don't know just how it happened, but anyway, I was assigned to pick him up and furnish transportation, take him to wherever he wanted to. He was a new kid in the block then. That dam was really the masterpiece claim of Murray's.
And so that was Senator James Murray.
Yes.
Who was U.S. Senator from Montana at the time.
And Mansfield was in support of it because he used his famous old remark when he was talking about his service clubs and that he always end up with wishing we had more power. And that was, and then the next thing he'd always say, well, just tap her light. That was one of his expressions that I didn't at that time understand what it meant, but I thought it had to do with cocktails and Butte. I didn't realize that what it was done was really an expression that the powder monkeys used when they plugged in the dynamite or charges.
In the Butte mines, where he was at one time a miner, yeah.
But he was a frequent visitor here, and he was a kind of a silent campaigner. He did it by getting a room in the hotel and then using a telephone, calling up his students that he knew. He kept in contact like that. And he was a great one for, must have had quite a clipping service, because if there was some event in some of the important families, he'd make a point to see that they got a card or some remembrance.
If there was a wedding in the family or a funeral or a new baby or something like that, then if he had any connection with them, whatever, he'd have maybe people on his staff watch the newspapers and they'd send a card to that person, which he would personally sign.
Yes, he was a low-key operator and remained that way even in the state when there were a group wanted to start a Mansfield think tank or some sort of a retreat house, and they were looking as an opportunity to get a land development. First it was going to be in Polson, and then they were going to move it up along the lake someplace, and they wanted Mansfield's support, but he personally never did endorse that whole program. And of course, it eventually, I guess there's still some support for his operation in the state. I don't know what it is.
Well, I think you're referring to the Mansfield Center for Asian and Pacific Studies, and that's headquartered at the Mike and Maureen Mansfield Library in the University of Montana. But I remember, as you do, that there was some interest in getting some kind of a facility built somewhere down in the Flathead Lake area.
Yeah.
And that Mansfield himself was a little bit reluctant about that. He thought that might be a little bit ostentatious, and he never was very wholeheartedly in support of it.
That's right. I was in the legislature at the time when we appropriated $1 million to go along with that. It looked like that program was going to go. And then when we found out it wasn't, I happened to be chairman of the Finance Committee at that time, and we asked for the money back, and we got it back. There was the piece of property, that I don't know whatever happened to it down there. they did have a small piece of land, which wasn't a very choice piece, so I don't know whatever happened, but I know the state got its money back.
And the important part of the reason for that was that Senator Mansfield wasn't remotely interested himself in raising money for the project, and
no.
There needed to be some money matched with the state money and that sort of thing, and so eventually the whole idea just collapsed.
Well, he's a modest sort of fellow, and he didn't want to have anybody take his name and capitalize on it for their benefit, and that's why I knew some relatives of his who said that he didn't want any part of it. Although I never talked to him about it.
Now, that modesty is a characteristic of Mansfield, and I'm curious, you knew him when he was a professor at the University of Montana, not well, but you knew him a little bit. You knew him also for years afterwards when you were the Republican County Chairman here in Flathead County, and then later on when you were a state legislator, you had contacts with him from time to time. Would you, in the early years, have guessed that he would have become the majority leader of the United States Senate?
No, I wouldn't have, because he wasn't an aggressive person. He didn't campaign aggressively. He, even when he switched from the House to the Senate, there was he wasn't aggressive in that area, but circumstances seemed to break just right for him, and he was a modest leader in the Senate. And of course, those were Democrat years, and he had seniority that grew up to a point where he inherited those positions largely than having achieved them. He survived to get them, is about probably the way to put it.
Now, you were the Republican County Chairman in Flathead County during the entire period that J. Hugo Aronson was governor. And we talked a little bit about the fact that when Aronson was first elected governor, the fellow that he defeated, Governor John Bonner, had been involved in an embarrassing incident at the National Governor's Convention down in Mississippi or Louisiana, I think, and that probably was helpful in Aronson's being elected governor in 1952. And so did you ever meet Governor Aronson? What were your impressions?
Oh yes, I knew him real well. The that period of time when I served in that capacity, you know, when he was governor, there was a time when the central committees in the counties had quite a bit of influence, because he was concerned about realizing that no officer is any better than his appointments would probably make him. And in fact, he leaned very heavily on the support that he had from the what was the brother's name? His advisors.
Wesley Castles?
Wesley Castles, and there was a newspaper man from
Fred Martin.
Fred Martin. Those two were really the steering men for him.
And they were very important and influential members of his administration.
Yes, well, at that time, see, the local people had a choice, had something to say about the liquor vendors and also the post office appointees. So we had a stronger organization in the counties then than now.
Because the county
precinct committee men and women were more active, because they had something to say about it.
They had something to say about people who might get some fairly decent state jobs.
That's right. Yeah. And Governor Aronson did something else when his crew provided the county central committees with the names of the vacancies that were coming up and appointments. And he asked to have you suggest people for them. And fortunately, I did a lot of it for him, and we had good appointments in New Orleans. We had the representation on the Board of Regents, the Highway Commission, the Fish and Game, and the medical boards, the dental boards,
were able to recommend good qualified people, and in every case they were appointed.
Yeah, he told me, he said, anytime you give me a recommendation, I know it's a good one. And so I had a special relationship with him. It was rather interesting, I think, just give you some idea of how he operated. When he retired, he went up to the soldiers' home up at Columbia Falls. And I'd go up there and visit with him, and it was rather an interesting thing. You sit down with him, and then the other patients there were always interested in visitors, and they'd come up, and he'd just raise his hand, and he'd say, this gentleman's my guest, please leave. I always thought that was kind of an interesting thing, because he didn't want to share his time with somebody else like that. So he was quite a governor, I think, in spirit. He was wise enough to know that he had limitations, and he got the best people he could get to steer the ship for him.
Matt, you mentioned in a previous conversation we had about Vic Morgan when you were the Republican county chairman, and he was the very Republican and new editor of the Daily Interlake, doing what he could to help Republican candidates. And I think you mentioned a time when he called you late at night and had you come down to the newspaper office.
Yes. Oh, he was very generous with his time and with the paper space. I'd complain about it and say, we can't pay this. And he'd say, don't worry about it. Let's get another page. And that's the way he'd go. And he was a colorful one. At that time, Truman came into this area and had a visit. And that was kind
President Harry Truman.
Yes. And there wasn't much of a parade, but he had the story in there that nothing stopped. There was nothing in town stopped, not even the dog that talked. Crossed the path ahead of his entourage there. Oh, he was a colorful fellow, and it was quite a, it was kind of a stirring time. The Young Turks that came in here, most all of us were for Eisenhower, and the old guard was for Taft, and we had quite a time when it came to selecting delegates, and the Taft people didn't want anybody else, of course, and so we negotiated, had quite a time, and finally we said we wanted one. So I think we ended up at that time, there were three for Taft and one for Eisenhower. But of course Eisenhower won that nomination anyway, but that was...
Now, I don't know this for sure, but I think Wellington D. Rankin was active in the Taft campaign in Montana. Is that your recollection?
Well, I'm sure he was a traditional one.
Yeah.
And he had a way of operating all his own. He was, when he ran for office, I had an experience with him. He came up and called me and wanted me to come to the hotel to see him, which I did. And he wanted to know how he was going to run in this county. And I said, I had no idea. I couldn't tell him. Well, was he going to win by 800 votes? And I said, I didn't know. Well, would he get 400? And I said, I don't know. All they're saying is the Treasury wouldn't be safe if you got there. And he said, well, he understood that. But he said that.
Because people questioned his personal honesty?
Yes, because he was hiring employees from the prisoner trustees to do some work on his ranches and that, and he was doing it, he thought, as a gesture of goodwill, but people looked at it in a different light. And he was rather an interesting one. I was with him one time visiting when Pink Miller, who was also an old Republican stalwart, but kind of an independent one. And he wanted to know that Rankin was getting some money from him. So he had a roll of bills. I don't know how many, but anyway, he came up and kind of slipped them over to Rankin. He was standing there, and Rankin turned and said, now, is this corporation money? No, no, it was his. And that was typical, I thought, of the old type of politics where there were people trying to buy some influence because Pink Miller thought that Rankin was going to make it, and he was never that much of a supporter in the party. As a matter of fact, when I got Don Buckingham, who was an employee of Miller's in the lumber yard, to run for county commissioner, and he didn't win. And after that was done, I met him one time, and he said, "How come you didn't ask me what Bob Buckingham?" I said, "I didn't think we had to." But to give you some idea that he wanted to have some control in those appointments, or he
wanted to have some influence.
Yeah.
And Pink Miller was a prominent lumberman in this area.
Yeah.
And he liked to be asked for his opinion, and he liked to give a big contribution to someone and make sure that he knew it.
That's old-fashioned politics, and that was going on here too. Probably still is.
Now, so you had a quite a good relationship with Governor Aronson. He was a big, good-natured Swedish immigrant, spoke with an accent. And then he was replaced after he retired from office, and a few years later ended up at the Veterans Home in Columbia Falls. He was replaced by Governor Don Nutter. And Nutter, as you mentioned, was killed in a plane crash. Just tell us your impressions of Nutter.
No, Nutter, Babcock was before Nutter.
No.
And then Nutter, and then Babcock.
Yeah, that's right. Nutter was governor from 1960 to 1962, and then killed in a plane crash and was followed by Babcock.
Yes.
And so your impressions, you were still Republican County Chairman at the time that Nutter was governor. This was before you'd entered the legislature. Share with us your impression of him.
Well, I only had one contact with him. Nutter, and I don't remember what the occasion was, but was it in his office, and I kind of like to dismiss the whole thing, but I wasn't impressed because I never felt comfortable with a lot of profane language and talk of that kind, and that was just a stream of profanity, and I left that session with him, and that's the only impression I had. And it's a bit unfair to think of him. I'm sure he probably was a good person, but I didn't like that approach.
He had the reputation for being kind of bold, kind of outspoken, that sort of thing. Is that your impression of him too?
Well, worse than that, it was a vulgar type of thing.
Yeah, I understand.
That's what turned me off. I couldn't understand somebody having strong feelings, but I didn't think that was the way to express them.
I understand. Then he was killed in a plane crash, and he was replaced by Governor Tim Babcock.
Yes.
And you, I think at about that time, became a member of the State House of Representatives, or soon after he was elected.
Yes.
And so you probably had a fair amount of dealings with Governor Babcock, because you were a member of the legislature most of the time he was governor. What are your recollections of him?
Well, I think he was trying, and I think I didn't agree with his method of appointments. When we had, instead of having a notice of what the vacancies were, and if we had someone to fill them, his office and his people who are guiding him would send a name of somebody and ask if you approved or disapproved. And I didn't go along with that. I didn't think if that's what he wanted, that was his. It wasn't for us to make the appointment. And I thought that was a weakness on his part, or with the group that he was working with.
Who were his key people? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember who they were entirely.
Because you do remember Fred Martin and Wes Castles, and obviously you had a good working relationship with them during the Aronson administration.
I didn't have that with the Babcock administration. Oh, I think Babcock had the right idea and was forceful enough he was the first one that really came out for the sales tax. And of course, he lost to the Governor Anderson on that slogan that, what was that now?
Pay more what for?
Yeah, pay more what for.
Now, Montanans have traditionally been opposed to a sales tax. Maybe you could share your thoughts a little bit about the sales tax and what the Republicans were trying to accomplish. I know you were a supporter of the sales tax idea.
Yes, well, see, up to about this time, the state really didn't need that kind of resource. We had mines working, the mills were working, the copper mines were working, oil and gas was being developed. There was we had an economy that could generate enough money because we didn't need that sort of thing. And the budget that we had were on the state level were so small compared to about the first time they had a couple million dollar budget. That was about, nothing like it is now. In fact, with all the funds, with the federal funds and with the general funds and the state, what do you call it, the earmark money, and then the federal money, and they could get along without, it really wasn't that imperative. But with, like all the other states had to go that way, and we thought that was the right way to go. And I still think that it's more important even now that the tax revenues be generated from the general economic progress or development or business of the state, not to try to penalize the homeowner or the retired people or rob some trust funds for current operations. It shouldn't be that way. The state's expenditure should be on the level with what the economy of the state is. And even with that, with 900,000 people paying, even if we broaden the tax base, it still isn't going to be enough to without having the natural resources that we have. If we can't develop those, if they can't be produced, where is it going to come from? It's got to come from the property owners and from incomes. And out of 900,000 people, we aren't going to be able to do that and have a budget that meets what your neighbors have. When your neighbors have a different economy and a different population base on which to generate that. So we've got ourselves into a serious situation as far as the state's concerned.
But your feeling in terms of a sales tax, then back in the 1960s and now, is, if I'm understanding you, is that in order to adequately and fairly provide for the legitimate needs of state government and the services that the people of the state require, if we no longer have an expanding natural resources base, that we're going to have a very narrow and perhaps unfair tax system if it only focuses on people who own property and pay property taxes or people who have income, and that we might be able to broaden our approach to taxation with a sales tax, maybe make our tax system a little more equitable and fair, and at the same time make it better able to pay for the services that the people in the state need. Is that a fair?
Yes. What we're doing now is, I see the legislature, we're taxing for bait money. We're baiting federal funds. And that's what's got us into trouble. We have, generally, there's about four budgets: the general fund, the state special revenue, that's earmarked or appropriated funds.
That would be like gasoline tax money would be,
yeah,
an example of that?
Those things that are statutory.
Yes.
And then there's federal funds that come in, and most all those are on a match basis. And then we have proprietary funds like generated from the state prison farm and that type of thing.
So when you use the term baiting, how I understand that is that we try in some way or other to come up with enough money to meet the federal matching requirement, and to some extent then the federal government's priorities become our own.
Yes, and the danger of that is, of course, when the feds back off from that, or they're characteristic in some of those programs, they start the program and then all of a sudden the program expires, yet your program in the state is operating, and they're left without resources. And now I understand that about something over 40% of the total budgets are federal money. And when I'm familiar, we had about $2 billion is what the budget was, and now it's up to $7 billion.
And you were chairman of the Senate Finance Committee back in the 1980s, two or three times, I think, when the budget was.
Yes, I was always on the Finance Committee. So my sympathies go with those that are trying to make this thing operate, and it's.
Now, Matt, Tim Babcock was defeated in 1968 by Forrest Anderson, and so that pretty much, even though the sales tax issue hasn't died, that was the first serious blow to it. I mean, I think Babcock's defeat was an indication that the people were opposed to a sales tax, and now as we conduct this interview 35 or 40 years later, that still seems to be the case. It seems as though Montana probably isn't any closer to a sales tax than we've ever been in any kind of broad-based tax reform. But when you, I guess prior to then, Governor Babcock was elected in 1964. Governor Nutter had been killed in a plane crash in 1962. So Babcock, who was lieutenant governor, became governor and then ran in his own right and was elected in 1964 in an election that was actually that particular election was a kind of a bad one for Republicans nationwide and in Montana. The Republican nominee was Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona. And earlier in our conversation, you had mentioned the John Birch Society, and maybe you could comment on the John Birch Society in the context of Goldwater's campaign. But also I want to ask you about the fact that you then were a statewide leader of Goldwater's primary opponent for the Republican nomination that year. You headed up the statewide campaign for Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York. How did you happen to get that job?
Well, that wasn't...
maybe that was 1968 when you were...
Going back into the John Birch organization was an ultra-conservative organization.
That particular election was a kind of a bad one for Republicans nationwide and in Montana. The Republican nominee was Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona. And earlier in our conversation, you had mentioned the John Birch Society, and maybe you could comment on the John Birch Society in the context of Goldwater's campaign. But also I want to ask you about the fact that you then were a statewide leader of Goldwater's primary opponent for the Republican nomination that year. You headed up the statewide campaign for Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York. How did you happen to get that job?
Well... That wasn't...
maybe that was 1968 when you were...
Going back into the Goldwater... I mean, the John Birch organization was an ultra-conservative organization which kind of took over on the Republican... got to be a wing of the Republican Party. Just like in some cases now, I understand we got some split in our party with some new name about, I don't know what they call themselves, but...
I think it's called the Republican Assembly or something,
yeah.
But I think it's similar.
Yeah, that's the type of thing, and it'll run its course, as this other one did too, but...
So the John Birchers were people who steered the Republicans as far to the right as they could politically.
Well, that was in the direction of Goldwater.
Yeah.
Well, then um, that um, the way I got involved with the Rockefeller, that was subsequently when Nixon was a candidate.
Okay, so then Goldwater was the Republican nominee in 64, and he was defeated. And then in 1968, I think, is when you took on the leadership of the Rockefeller campaign, when Nixon and I think Ronald Reagan and some of the others were all running in 1968. Maybe Romney and Scranton, or maybe they were in 68.
Well, I've got the timing a little bit mixed up there. I thought it was later than that, when the challenge was the re-election of Nixon
in 72.
And Goldwater and Rockefeller.
That should have been in 68, I think.
Well, whenever that was, those were the two ones. Because the reason how I got in connected with that, there was a fellow by the name of Leonard Hall, who was a national chairman.
Republican national chairman.
And a friend, a personal friend of Rockefeller's. And he this Hall used to come out here and visit a party that he knew out there in all around Echo Lake.
Knew some people here locally at Echo Lake, east of Kalispell.
And when he came out, be invited out there to visit with him, and that was my contact, came up with him and with Hall. And Hall was there were several interested in the state of getting on Rockefeller's bandwagon, and Hall didn't want him. He didn't go with that, so he asked me if I would do it. And I kind of admired the Rockefeller operation after he'd been elected governor of New York three times. And he obviously was a person of some stature to do that. And that was, I knew Montana's delegation at that time was headed by Babcock, Governor Babcock. And I knew that it was going to be a Nixon delegation.
Yeah, because Babcock had endorsed Nixon.
Yeah. And so I talked to Babcock to see if we could get if we couldn't have the delegates go uncommitted, even though you knew what they were going to do. My experience with those national conventions, you didn't want to go committed. If you went committed, you were just set aside. They didn't pay attention to you. They're more interesting if they weren't. And he agreed to do that. It was quite a courtesy thing, I felt personally. They wouldn't commit publicly that they were for Nixon, although we knew they were. And then Rockefeller wanted me to go to Florida where they were having that national convention. I told him there wasn't any point in going. I knew I could tell you what's going to happen as far as our delegates were concerned, but that was the best I could.
Did you meet Rockefeller personally?
Yes. He made a quick stop through the state in Helena a very short time. I had a little problem with that. I told him when he came in here to forget to not start talking about gun control. And that was the first thing he started on. And the press got on him on that one, of course.
So he was in favor of some kind of control of guns and firearms?
Yeah.
Which, of course, would be an unpopular issue in Montana.
Well, sure. Yeah, I asked him if he suggested he stay away from that one, but he didn't. And of course the press was after him, and didn't make any difference. But as it turned out he would have been I still think he would have been the better one, the way that turned out for
Nixon. Because Goldwater was defeated disastrously in 64 when Rockefeller was a contender for the presidential nomination, and then in 68 Nixon won and then turned out to have a terrible experience as president.
So. Yeah, that was right. But it's been an interesting experience in the organization and working with people. And the party, though, doesn't have the organizational strength that they used to have. There's no question about that. The direct primary has broken that down, and now they there's a movement to get people to register by party in this state. And the way we have that is not, didn't have to register by party. I don't know how that'll play out, but.
Traditionally, there's been a lot of opposition to party registration in Montana, I think.
Yes, it has been, yeah.
Now, Matt, you were Republican County Chairman of Flathead County in the 1950s. And I know during that period of time, up into the 60s and perhaps into the 70s, the Anaconda Company, most historians agree, has had a significant amount of influence in the state's economy, in the state's politics, that sort of thing. I've heard it mentioned that Anaconda Company people circulated around Montana somewhat. They perhaps talked to legislators, county chairmen, that sort of thing, kept tabs on what was going on in communities. They were interested in who was elected to the legislature. They had a big hospitality room over in Helena in the Placer Hotel during the period of time when you were a legislator. Any experiences with Anaconda Company people or any thoughts about their involvement and their influence?
No, never any contact at all with them except that as with the lobbyists during the sessions over there. I had no contact with them.
When you were Republican County Chairman, you don't recall the Anaconda Company guy checking in with you and talking with you a little bit?
No.
Now, Representative Ori Armstrong, perhaps, might have been a local contact person. Would you think so?
Well, he was a Speaker of the House at one time, and he was a real estate and insurance man here, and he had an uncanny contact. I don't know how he had it, seemed to have it with the railroads. He had it with all the powers that be. And so whatever influence, never even talked about. But I'm sure that, I'm sure Armstrong was aware of it. My only interest in it was a pleasant experience with their hospitality rooms.
Tell me about that.
Well, they were just festive rooms of food, and they were friendly, kind people. They were doing a good job, but at that time the Anaconda didn't have the horses that they once ran. I think that's the way to put it.
This would have been in the 1960s, when you
were... Yeah, all the time I was there.
You didn't have the impression that they were a controlling influence?
No, no, not at all.
And so how would you describe the hospitality room?
Well, they were just what they were. They were attractive meeting places where people... legislators met, or as you know, you don't have much time to spend in those places. It's kind of touch and go.
But it was an opportunity maybe to just sit down and casually visit with other legislators and
that sort
of thing in a pleasant environment and relaxed atmosphere and so on.
Yeah, that was quite a center in Helena in those days when they used the old hotel. Later when that broke up, they used to have some hospitality rooms in a few places, but it was never like they did at first.
Do you have any impression of the Montana Power Company during that same period of time?
No. I never, maybe I'm not sensitive to those things, but or maybe they thought there's no point in talking to me about it, but I never had any comment at all or any pressure.
Did you know Lloyd Crippen or Everett Shuey?
Yeah.
Obvious. So you'd had maybe visits with them from time to time?
Not very much. I wouldn't say I was really personally acquainted much with them. They were in a different crowd than I seemed to be.
Matt, do you remember in your experience in the legislature any lobbyist of any type or kind that stands out in your memory?
No, I don't think I can.
How about a legislator? Are there particular legislators that are prominent in your recollection?
Oh, a lot of them, but not. I don't know special characters as well. There were some characters, of course, like Elmer Shai,
yeah.
Somebody that, he'd get upset about something and pile his books on his desk and go get his hat and coat. He was leaving. Well, at first it kind of excited people, and after he did that about two or three times, they just forgot about it.
He was going to say the heck with that place and go back to White Sulphur Springs.
He had difficulty with Bardinal for some reason.
Representing Francis Bardinal.
Yes, for some reason they clashed about everything, and they'd shout at one another, and then both of them would get kind of excited, and Francis Bardinal never threatened to get up and leave, but Elmer Shai, he packed up a couple of times, but he was always back the next day.
What's your recollection of Jim Felt, Speaker of the House in 1967?
Felt?
Yeah.
Well, he was pretty... I think he did a good job. He was pretty formal. He was, I knew his family, knew his father better than I knew him. His father was a judge in eastern Montana down Fallon County. And he was a real fine fellow. And Felt was, I didn't have any particular, I thought he ran a good ship.
Jim Lucas, Speaker of the House after
Felt. Yeah, I think he was effective. I thought he would stay with that and become more of a political figure, but he was a capable, good man.
Now, both Felt and Lucas were Republican leaders in the House of Representatives at the time that the sales tax was a prominent issue, and both of them were closely associated along with Babcock with the sales tax. Is that your recollection too?
Yeah, and it was a tough time for them, because when we went there in 66, I think we had a 24 majority in the House, Republican majority. The next 2 years we had 12, the next 2 years we had 6, but the trouble with the 6 is there were 3 of them that wouldn't go along with us, and that was... That was Big Ed Smith and Gary Marbert and a fellow by the name of Lou Perry. And they were the ones that wouldn't go along. With the sales tax. Of course, we didn't control the Senate anyway, but we couldn't get it out of the House.
Now, you served with Big Ed Smith, of course. You just mentioned him.
Yes.
And he later ran for governor. Any impressions of him?
Well, I think he was out of his league, very much. He was a very conscientious fellow and a bold fellow.
Bold?
Bold, yeah. Uh-huh. But he was, he was a seatmate. My first years I was in there, and he was a rare one to be elected in that part of the state, really, as a Republican.
Republicans hadn't had much success in elections up in his part of the state until his election.
He was, so he felt like he was kind of anointed in that, and he was pretty strong in his convictions, and he and Marbert and Perry were the ones that we had difficulty with. And we used to have a caucus at that time. We used to have a caucus in the old highway building, and it got so that they were so spooked about whether or not there was a leak in from there that they were checking to see whether there was any electronic devices that were being picked up, and I don't think there ever was, and it wasn't that important, but I know that there was a time when they didn't want those three in there.
In the caucus.
Because in the caucus, yeah.
And that was the time when, that was in 1971, when we were still functioning under the 1889 Constitution, and when the legislature only met 60 days, but if my memory serves, the legislature met something like 107 days or something during that session because of the deadlock on the sales tax and the inability to get a sales tax out of the House to balance the budget and the...
I don't remember anything that long. I remember that I was there one time when they put a... they hung a drape over the clock.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so but I think we were only there a couple days after the, but not any great length of time.
But don't you remember when Governor Anderson called us back again?
Yeah, I remember.
I think we met off and on until June that year.
We had a lot of special sessions.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, all through the years I was there, there seemed to be a special session about every time.
Now, you served also under Governor Forrest Anderson. Any thoughts or impressions about him?
No. I thought my impressions that he was strong and believed in his convictions were pretty genuine. And no, I have no adverse. In fact, I admired him. We had some research being done on some tax thing. I believe it was, what was his name, Dean? There was a big tax study that was made.
Bill Deal?
Deal, yeah. Deal study. And somehow, the one time in one of the meetings, that came up and they were going to pick it apart. And he said that he put a stop right there. There was nothing wrong with that study. And I don't remember what the issue was, but anyway, he wouldn't entertain a criticism coming in, someone taking that apart.
So he could take charge. He was a sort of a take charge guy?
Yeah, he was.
And then you also served with Governor Tom Judge?
Yeah.
Both in the legislature and as governor.
Yeah, yes. Well, I got along fine with him. He was pretty proud of being governor. He dressed like the governor, and he was...
looked sharp.
He commanded attention. I think he made a good front to it. And at that time, if you remember, there was a lot of federal money came into being, and so... We got along, made the legislature look pretty good at that time. And I did have some contact with him. At that time, I introduced a Leato bill, that cancer bill. Leato was this sort of a pit process.
Some kind of a derivative of apricot pits or peach pits or something?
I didn't know whether it was any good or not, but it seemed to, there was some real active interest in it, and of course lots of stories of how wonderful it was, and the medical group didn't like it, but my argument was that if they'd exhausted all other means, I didn't see why anyone should be denied the help, even if it were just psychological. And I got it through, got it to the... I had a little bit of a problem in the House, didn't know whether it was going to go, but it went through, and one of them came over and said, "You got too many friends over here." So it went through, and it went to the governor, and he called me about it, and I told him what I said. I don't know whether it's any good or not, but my arguments were just that if they'd exhausted every other means they knew, and if it gave any kind of help, physical or psychological, I was for it. And he said, well, he had a brother, I think it was a doctor over in Spokane that time. He said he talked to his brother about it, and he didn't seem to be very upset about it. It wasn't, so he said, well, he'd sign it. So that's how that got on the books. And you know, just it wasn't very long. Well, the woman that's cooking for us here has relatives that are still taking that.
Saying, really? Still taking land for us?
Saying that's good. They're doing well with that.
Well, good.
There's no scientific reason for it, I guess.
Well, good. Well, maybe sometimes things are hard to understand and explain.
Yeah, I was dumbfounded when I heard that was her relatives were using that drug.
Now, Matt, you knew, of course, Governor Ted Swindon.
Yes.
And well, you served, in fact, you were chairman of the Finance Committee for a fair amount of the time when he was governor.
Well, in my opinion, I think he was one of the best of the group, of all of them that I served with, maybe because he seemed to be good to me, too. And, well, for instance, there was an appropriation given to the set aside by the governor, the judge had, for doing something, I don't know how it was set aside for something for him to decide. And he was he offered it to the Kalispell Bridge Group, Park Group, that it was a matching deal, around $400,000. And the city couldn't match it, and so it was still on the books when Swindon came in, and I somehow I knew about it, so I asked him if we couldn't transfer that up to, at that time they were concerned about the development up here of the Lone Pine.
Yeah, Lone Pine State Park.
The people who were living up there didn't want it to be a roughhouse park. They were running cars and stuff up and down, the motorcycles and stuff up the hills. They didn't like that. They wanted something different. And so I asked him if we couldn't transfer that. And he said, sure, he'd do that. So that got transferred to that project up there. That's how that came to life. And this was with Swindon. And then I liked his approach with the employee. He was pretty liberal as a legislator, but when he was governor, he drew the line pretty tight. And he had the notion that there were certain limits and we couldn't go beyond that. And the threats that were made for state employees or the hospital employees, you know, that type of thing, it usually is periodic in the legislature. They're always going to strike. And the university bunch were begging him on that. And he held the line on that, and I thought he should.
Held the line on the budget pretty well.
Yeah. He said that's as far as we could go, and that was it. Yeah, I think he was one of the best, I think. And he had one of the smoothest, too, in his department. He was very modest, you know. He didn't have to have a driver or a car. He didn't have to have a protector with him. And his family, he had a telephone at the house or at the governor's. He was just a good guy, I thought. My experience was good with him.
How about Governor Stan Stevens? You served in the legislature with him extensively and also served in the legislature while he was governor.
I think he had got a tough break, I think. It was, he had plenty of support to start with, but he had the misfortune of, again, a person in those positions is no better than someone else makes them, usually staffed people. Well, he seemed to have difficulty making appointments that didn't turn out. They turned out to be an embarrassment to him, even the point where the lieutenant governor resigned.
Alan Colstead,
which is kind of an unheard of thing. And So Stan, I think he suffered a lot of difficulty that really wasn't his fault, but the chips just didn't fall right for him at all.
Do you know him personally?
Yes.
I imagine quite well.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, Matt, you're a lifelong Republican and proud of it. Your father served in the state Senate before you did, I think, in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Maybe since we've just got a few minutes left, we could conclude a little bit with maybe you're describing how you became interested in politics, what got you involved in public service, because your public service has extended really beyond the political realm. You served on the National Board of Directors of the Red Cross. You served, I believe, as the president of the Montana Auto Dealers Association. You've been active in Chamber of Commerce, Kiwanis, your church, many things. What in your background caused you to be such a public-spirited person?
Well, I think it came partly from, I had an uncle that was a judge in Minnesota when I was going to school back there, and he was a power in the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, which identified nationally as a Democrat party. And in order to get Minnesota's Democrat vote, he was courted by the Farley. You remember the...
Yeah, James Farley was Postmaster General in the FDR administration.
He was kind of the point man. He was supposed to be picking up. I saw letters from him in his green ink that inviting him to come to Washington, and they were thinking about an ambassador to Austria. That was his native land. And
that was your uncle's native land?
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I was in school when that thing was going on. I made some trips with him. So there was a possibility that he was going to go there. And then I was interested in foreign...
That your uncle might even have been the ambassador to Austria.
Foreign service, I thought.
Well, you were personally interested, perhaps, in going into the Foreign Service.
Yeah. And he invited down there once, and then they invited him down here the second time. And then he thought, well, he couldn't figure out just what it was. And I guess he went back the third time, and then they told him, well, the situation in Europe was such that they were going to have the career people in that job in Austria, which I can understand at that time was true, probably. So he didn't get anything out of that. But I was, although I was a Republican, a different party than he was. Then my father was serving in the legislature, and an aunt of mine was in the county treasurer, and we've been kind of interested in public affairs all the time.
But Matt, what was it about the Republican Party philosophy that attracted you? Obviously, your dad had influence.
Well,
and your dad was a Republican.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I have made me Republican, I always thought that the individual had a responsibility to do the best he could in whatever he was doing, and if he's free to do it, and then let him win or lose. In other words, the responsibility of whether I succeeded or failed was my problem, not yours. And that was the whole idea of being independent. I think that had a lot to do with me, independence and freedom, and against this idea that somebody else was going to protect you or license you. You had to do something because of somebody else, this type of thing. But I think it was the freedom idea that appealed to me. And even though it came up through the Depression when it was popular that the government was going to take care of people and all this, or, well, they had to do something like that. But I didn't like that idea in the first place.
Ben. So your philosophy has always been to try to keep the role of government reduced as much as possible.
Yeah, and that the individual should be given every opportunity to express himself and to succeed or fail, if that's the case.
But of course, you still recognize a role of government, because we talked earlier in our interview about the idea that we need some kind of a tax system that's...
Yeah, there are certain, sure. There's developed in a civilized society that there's got to be some cooperation, protection. The police protection deals, I think, are right. The health, moral safety, that type of thing, that you have to have that. But I think primarily it's we should be free more to operate. Of course, I've realized in the government setup and in the corporate structure and in the educational system, everything has changed so that society seems to feel that these things have to be done, made available for you to survive. And I kind of the old school, and believe me, I coming up through the Depression, I know what it's like to not have anything and then starve. My folks lost everything in the banking business, and so we saw some good times, and then we saw some of the tough times too, with the Depression years, which strung out. Although personally, I've had some real breaks, opportunity that I found most rewarding. When I went to college, went to school in Minnesota, and had the first, my sister and her twin sister and I went back. I went to a private school and she went to a private school. And that was the first year. Well, then the banks closed, we didn't have anything. And even her savings and my savings were tied up. We didn't have very much. Thought was, well, she could, would see that I could get a job and see that she got through school and then she could help me. Well, that was what the plan was. So we got her back to school and I went over to campus at St. John's, and the first guy I met there was the dean, just happened to be, and he said, well, I don't want to know where I'd been. I said, well, I wasn't going to be able to make it. And he said, why not? And I told him. Oh, he says, you did a good job here. Just call your folks and tell them you're staying. One more, we can take one more for sure. So I got a ride all the way through.
Full ride scholarship.
The whole bit. And then when I got finished, I went to the president and asked what I could do. Well, he says, you can sign a note and pay for it when you can. Well, of course, that was only $400 a year. I just signed a note for $1,200 for 3 years, board and room and all.
Huh.
And so I did that and got a job, started paying it off, and then they were collecting, during the wartime, trying to collect some money, and they offered me a little discount. I don't know what it was, if I could pay it, so I paid it all off at that time. And then since then I've paid it, I guess I've given them, it must have been about, well, I traded, gave them a whole bunch of stock that was worth about $25,000 to help somebody like they helped me, and I keep doing that.
So you've paid St. John's College in Minnesota back many, many times,
yeah,
for the wonderful generosity that they extended to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Made a big difference for me. Gee, that was a...
Made it possible for you to be a teacher and a coach and go on to graduate school at the University of
Washington. I don't know what would ever happen. It wouldn't have worked out, because my sister stayed down there and she joined the convent. So she wasn't going to be helping
me. She joined the convent?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She wasn't going to help me any of that.
Well, that's a wonderful story and a good story.
Yeah, I had some good breaks.
Well, you
but on the other hand, you kind of make those breaks
too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
you'd obviously been a good student. I think you'd been an outstanding athlete, and that's why they wanted you to come back.
Yeah, he was. He said, "You've done a good job here. We can take one more."
You know, Matt, we've just got a couple minutes left on the tape, but I remember once in a conversation we had some years ago, you mentioned that you were a baseball player in college, and that one of your classmates, also on the baseball team in college, was later to become the United States Senator Eugene McCarthy from Minnesota, and also a presidential candidate.
My
brother. Oh,
he was a classmate of my brother's.
Was it at the same school?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, he was. McCarthy was a year behind me.
I see. You knew him in college, though?
Yeah, sure. I knew him well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you maintained some contact with him over the years, too?
No, I never did. When he was in Helena, weren't you with me when we stopped there to see him? He
was
through.
I think you're thinking of Russ Doty.
I think you were there. We tried to get...
Oh, maybe we tried to. We didn't see him, though.
No, we tried to get to see him, and they wouldn't let me in.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. And I never had any contact with him. Well, he turned out to be kind of a intellectual hermit, I guess you'd call him.
An intellectual hermit.
Yeah. He was a good student, so.
Yeah, I'll bet he was.
And he was a good ball player and a hockey player. But that was my brother. I never played baseball.
Just got about a minute left. Anything to say in conclusion? Anything you'd like to say?
Well, this country has been good to me. The people here have, too. I've enjoyed working, having lots of opportunity to serve, and it's been a pleasant and rewarding experience. Been in the automobile business, the banking business, the radio business, and they were never too profitable in themselves, but I was very fortunate in the way things out have developed for me.
Well, you've certainly made an important contribution, and it's certainly been my great pleasure to know you. And in fact, I probably consider you one of two or three real mentor figures in my life, Matt. So certainly appreciate your helping us with this interview.
Well, thank you.